This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees at 7:35. Global warming and climate change will be what everyone is talking about at a hearing today in Pittsburgh. The public forum is one of four meetings taking place across the country this week as the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency seeks input on its newly proposed rules to cut carbon dioxide emissions from the nation's power plants. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on this move by the EPA.
The proposals are the cornerstone of Obama's efforts to combat global warming. The EPA's plan includes state-by-state targets, but lets the states decide how to get there. The agency created four categories of reductions: coal plant efficiencies, replacing coal with natural gas, adding renewables and nuclear power, and energy conservation. Some environmentalists welcome the move, but fear that state officials will protect Pennsylvania's powerful fossil fuel industry. Joe Minot is the executive director of the Clean Air Council.
Clearly, Pennsylvania is going to look after coal. They're going to look after natural gas. But that doesn't mean they have to do that at the expense of promoting energy efficiency and alternative energy.
While details are hashed out at the state level, powerful national interests oppose EPA's authority to even set greenhouse gas standards. Scott Siegel is the executive director of the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council, which represents utilities that rely heavily on coal to produce their electricity. He says the potential loss of fossil fuel plants on a national level would raise costs and threaten the reliability of the electrical grid during severe cold or hot weather.
Power needs to be dispatched to consumers based on whatever's cheapest. Well, the agency, in one fell swoop, is trying to change that and saying, no, actually dispatch by order of carbon. Well, there is no mechanism to do that. It's just a breathtaking assertion of authority.
Siegel says the EPA is trying to force a square peg into a round hole by using the Clean Air Act to regulate climate change. The hearings this week are just the start to what may turn out to be protracted legal battles over the rules and EPA's authority. I'm Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
If even hearing the word ragweed makes your eyes water, you might be one of nearly 45 million Americans with seasonal allergies. And allergists say the number of people with sensitivities to ragweed and other plants is growing. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant looks at how climate change is fueling the rise in allergies and asthma.
Jenny Fisher has been taking over-the-counter medication for allergies for a long time. Without it, she suffers cold-like symptoms, a runny nose, sneezing, and congestion. An allergy pill usually made it better, but a couple of years ago, things started to get worse.
I'd be out at 5:30 in the morning walking my dog, and it would just be huffing and puffing, and, you know, I couldn't catch my breath. It's scary.
Her doctor, David Schoner, diagnosed her with asthma. Like many allergists, he's seeing more patients with allergies, and those allergies are getting more severe. Schoner spends his lunch hour filling out new prescriptions.
The number of patients calling in for appointments for allergies has just skyrocketed.
The American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology says a top reason for that is climate change. Higher temperatures and carbon dioxide levels are affecting plants, and that's leading to more allergies. Immunologist Asha Patel walks up to the roof of Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh every morning to take pollen counts. She uses a machine called a spore trap. It looks kind of like a small weather vane, and Patel says it pulls in air like a large nose.
It's like there's a suction created. So it draws the air through this opening right here, and the sample is collected inside.
Patel takes a glass microscope slide out of the spore trap. It's the one she put in yesterday, and it's covered with speckles. She takes it down to the lab and dots on pink dye. Under the microscope, she watches as a perfect circle emerges. She says it's the pollen from a common weed.
Here's the English plantain. It's one of the weed.
Researchers do this kind of pollen collection all over the country, and they've seen trends emerge. Dr. Leonard Bielery of Rutgers University has been studying the connection between pollen levels and the throng showing up at his office.
I saw a hidden signal in the pollen count changing over time. And as such, then I started correlating that we're seeing patients earlier and more patients. The volume seems to be increasing. And some who are moderate or mild in years past are now more severe.
In a study published by the National Academy of Sciences, Bielery and other researchers looked at a common allergen, ragweed, in the Midwest and Canada. In Canada, they found the ragweed season was almost a month longer in 2009 than in 1995. Billery says the ragweed season in our region is about 5 days longer than it was 20 years ago. Researchers looking at the impacts of climate change also find that as carbon dioxide levels rise, the pollen is becoming more severe. Louis Ziska is a researcher with the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Just changing the CO2 from the early part of the 20th century to the latter part of the 20th century, for example, doubles the production of pollen from a single plant. And there was some indication that it was also more allergenic pollen, that is, it was producing more of the proteins that people are allergic to.
Researcher Leonard Billery says the worsening pollen is especially dangerous for children who already have respiratory problems.
And you will cause an inflammatory mix, or I call the witch's brew, where we have the temperature, ozone, and pollen all mixed together. You will cause an incredible inflammatory response to the eyes, nose, and therefore, in those who are more prone to it, the lungs as well, leading to more asthma.
Billery says on high pollen days, people with respiratory problems can take over-the-counter medicine preventatively, so itchy eyes and runny noses don't turn into dangerous asthma. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:42. Some fog this morning, becoming mostly sunny today. Temperatures in the 70s and 80s. Rain moves into the forecast tonight and tomorrow. Lows tonight in the 50s and 60s. Highs tomorrow in the 70s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit wvdrs.org for employer services.
NPR has a new president and CEO. Jarl Mohn was once a commercial radio DJ, but he says he has a passion for public radio. That's why he chaired Southern California Public Radio, even as he made his career in cable TV as president and CEO of E! Entertainment Television. Mohn stopped by West Virginia Public Broadcasting in Charleston yesterday as part of a cross-country tour of public radio stations.
You have a career in cable television. You began E! Entertainment Network.
Yep.
What does your career in cable television bring to a national public radio network? And also, I know that you are very involved in public radio in California. Mm-hmm. So how do the two mesh together here?
Well, they actually do.
Okay.
And the parts that are a little separate, I was involved locally with Southern California Public Radio and KPCC as a board member and a donor and then ultimately chairman of the board. So I've spent a lot of time at public radio on the local side. I've also, the last 8 years, been on the board of the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at USC, and 6 of those 8 years I was chairman there. So I have ties to journalism, although I'm not a journalist or a news person myself. I have great respect and see my role in those organizations and now at NPR as being a supporter of people that are journalists. That's, I think, my role. Where the cable TV stuff comes in my previous career in radio, I think of myself primarily as a marketing person and also as a business person. So I think I can help market national public radio, NPR stations, public radio better than it has been done. It hasn't really been, no one's really addressed that in a big way, in my opinion. We have a great brand. We haven't had great branding. We can do that. But the most important one is bringing certain business disciplines. We've had great content, great producers, loyal audience, this remarkable history of great content. But the business side of the business has really not done particularly well. I think my background in business is what I can be helpful to get the organization on great footing and make sure that the people who are journalists, who are reporters, who are producers, have the tools and the resources they need. They can do the best work that they've done in their careers.
Let's turn to local stations. Mm-hmm. You've been visiting local stations throughout the country this week, and you've probably learned a great deal.
Yes.
In just about every public radio station, the issue is we need more listeners and we need more money. and listeners complain that we fundraise all the time. Any ideas here?
Well, we have a few. Yes, I think part of the financial problem is not having enough listeners. We can always have more listeners. I think we have a bigger issue of the people that are listening not supporting enough. It's a handful of people that that become members. Nationally, I don't know what it is here in West Virginia, but nationally, the number is roughly 10%. 10% of your listening base become members.
That's about right here.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's this wonderful 90% opportunity, even if we don't get one more listener. I think that's a lot easier to do than to bring a lot more people into the tent. The other things we can do on a fundraising front to get away from the pledge drives, which most people just dread inside the radio stations and outside the radio stations, is to do a nationwide capital campaign. It's never been done at NPR with the stations to raise a lot of money so that there can be a less of a focus on pledge drives.
NPR has just launched a new app mm-hmm. called NPR One. This is really an ingenious invention.
Oh, great.
It allows users to listen to NPR stories and local public radio stories from West Virginia Public Radio. And it includes a method for users to donate to their local public radio stations. Oh, good, more fundraising. It seems that you don't need a radio to listen to the radio anymore, doesn't it?
Well, you don't, but many people and most people still do. I don't see them as competing platforms. I see them as complementary platforms. When one is in one's car and has a radio there, it's the perfect platform. Walking around your house from room to room, it might make more sense to listen to a radio. But there are places where the digital technology is really is the only way you can listen it. Mm-hmm. The great thing, another thing about NPR One is you can customize ultimately the stories. It starts to learn what you like and you don't like. You hit the button that says the stories you think are most interesting, and it starts to recognize, oh, you like health stories, or oh, you like stories about politics. You don't do that with other stories. Pretty soon it starts to assemble stories that are more interesting to you. So that technology is kind of interesting and fun.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like there really is an attitude at NPR to partner with member stations. It would have been easy for NPR to invent this app and have only NPR stories on it. But there's local public radio involved as well. There's local donation involved mm-hmm. as well. I think in the NPR public radio land, there was a worry that NPR didn't need its member stations anymore. But from what I hear from you, that is not the case. There is still a great partnership to be had between NPR and its member stations.
I think there's an incredible opportunity for both local stations and for NPR in many ways. Collaborative fundraising, collaborative journalism, collaborative news gathering, and collaborative marketing. And I think the organization NPR is going to be stronger if the stations are stronger. And if the stations are stronger, then NPR is going to be stronger. And just one example, the app you're talking about, NPR One. Let's say we didn't have your stories, West Virginia Public Radio's stories, on the NPR One app. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not as interesting if you live in Charleston. It's not as good for people that live in this area. They want to know what's going on here. And just having national stories makes it a weaker service, in my opinion. So in any community around the United States, whether it's L.A., whether it's Washington, D.C., Charleston, West Virginia, we were in Logan, Utah, we were in Missoula, Montana on this little tour across the country. If that local public radio station contributes stories for the digital platform, it makes that much more interesting to the people in that community.
Yarrow Moon, President and CEO of NPR. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All righty.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.